This is the Multifamily Takeoff Podcast, episode number 19.
And now, out of San Diego, California, streaming to listeners around the world, this is the Multifamily Takeoff Podcast, where we'll talk all aspects of anything multifamily real estate investing related, as we host a variety of guests who are active in the apartment game. Be sure to follow the show on Instagram at the Multifamily Takeoff. Now, here are your hosts, Mike Tai, Sean DeMartel, and Rich Summers.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for listening. I am your host, Sean DeMartel. Mike Tai couldn't join us today for this episode. So the other co-host with me today is going to be Rich Summers. Welcome in, Rich.
Hey, Big Sean. Thank you, sir. How you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm staying healthy. I know you are. I hope all our listeners out there are doing the best they can to hunker down, stay in place, stay at home, and stay healthy so that we can nip this COVID-19 thing in the butt. So our best wishes are out there to all of our listeners who are going through this economic crisis and health crisis with us. But today we have a really great guest. We're going to talk about some COVID stuff as well. His name is Neil Bawa. Neil is one of the larger syndicators in the United States. And we love him because he's got a lot of unique approaches to asset management that you've probably never heard of before. He takes a laser focus on any way he can increase the net operating income. And he employs an entire, what he calls an army of employees that are virtual assistants in the Philippines that work around the clock for him to increase leads, to find ways of, you know, getting more people to sign up for whether it's covered parking, pet rent, whatever. You're going to learn about some things that you've definitely never heard about. He calls them his patented approaches, and it's really cool. We do talk quite a bit about COVID-19. He looks into his own little crystal ball and what he foresees happening in the market over the next 12 months. And we talk about what he's doing today as far as asset management to try and mitigate the effects this is going to have across his portfolio. So there's a lot to be had in this episode. It's definitely one of our top episodes. A lot of new and creative content. What do you think, Rich?
Yeah, honestly, one of my probably top two or three episodes that we've ever recorded. So much good knowledge. I think that all you guys are going to love it. Again, if you guys enjoy our content, there's no better way to give back but to drop us a 5-star rating. And without further ado, let's go ahead and bring them in.
Checking in with us from the San Francisco Bay Area, it's Mr. Neil Bawa. Neil, welcome in.
Thanks, Sean and Rich. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, thanks for coming on, Neil. I know us and our listeners are super excited for this.
Yeah, we've been waiting for this one. This is awesome. So for our listeners out there that aren't familiar with Neil Bawa, could you just briefly give everybody an overview of your background and what you do in the multifamily space?
Sure. I am a reformed technologist. I'm a geek and proud of it. I use my data science background and my data analytics background to find and buy large multifamily apartment complexes in the U.S., $250 million portfolio, about 500 active investors, and about 30,000 people in our database that follow what we do. We do a very large number of community webinars. We usually do 2 a week and get about 1,000 people on those webinars every week. So our brand is really built on delivery of knowledge and data to people. And people who like that get attracted to us and invest with us in our projects. Our projects are a mix of multifamily and student housing, public storage. Those are the 3 verticals that we buy in. We both buy and build projects. So I like building because I started in my real estate career with a new construction project and then went backwards to value add. So that's a little bit about me.
Neil, just curious, what was it that you were doing prior to real estate? And then what was it that triggered you to get into real estate investing in general?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I was in high technology here in the San Francisco Bay Area, Silicon Valley. And I got into real estate in reverse. Most people start with a single value add or rehab property or buy and hold rental. In my case, I was chief operations officer of a technology company, and my CEO asked for my help to build a campus for our company's usage, a custom office campus from scratch. And so in 2003, he and I worked together to build a $6 million campus from scratch, 27,000 square feet. And that's how I got my real estate jobs.
Very awesome, Neil. And before we kind of get into specifics here, where do you like to invest? What kind of markets are you invested in right now?
So I am best known for my data analytics driven market studies. So I have a course which is very popular. It's on udemy.com. That's udemy.com/realfocus. And that course is currently being taken by 5,000 people all across the US. So if you go to that course page on udemy.com, you'll see about 5,000 other people taking it. And it's based on five metrics for picking cities, and we can talk about them if you wish. But the answer to your question is, my list of cities changes depending upon their job growth, home price growth, population growth, income growth, and crime reduction. Those are my five city level statistics. As a result, my list of cities each year is different.
Awesome. And let's go ahead and get into that then a little bit. Can you kind of, those five statistics that you look at, where do you pull this information from? And then why specifically do you look at those statistics?
Absolutely. So there's two ways of getting the information. One is paid, neighborhoodscout.com, which is $39 a month. And you can pull 10 reports for 10 different addresses anywhere in the US. The free method, which I'm going to give you, is described in great detail on that Udemy course, which is why I highly recommend you go to udemy.com/realfocus, because it's a 3-hour course, and we'll give you a shorter version of it on this podcast. But as I mentioned, my five real focuses, the first real focus is population growth. And the rule is that you want roughly 21% population growth, give or take 0.5%, between the year 2000 and the year 2017. And you might say, well, why 2017? We're in 2020 now. Well, firstly, cities don't change that much in a few years. Even if you had 2020 data, you'd pretty much end up with the same set of cities using that rule. So 21.5%. And where do you find the information? Very simple. Type in the name of your city followed by population into Google, and Google will give you a graph. That graph will show you that the 2000 number and the 2017 number, those two numbers, if the difference between them is more than 21.5%, that's a very strong city to invest in. If you go to my Udemy course, there's an Excel spreadsheet that allows you to just take the two numbers and plug them in, and the spreadsheet gives you a thumbs up or thumbs down, depending upon whether the gap is more than 21.5% or not. Population growth is the biggest driver of real estate profits. And the reason for that is now there's more people competing for the same real estate, for the same amount of land. And nothing works as well as that. In case of rent growth, in terms of appreciation, population growth is very powerful.
So Neil, to piggyback off of the population growth, you got your employment growth as well, which is another important factor. And we like to use Neighborhood Scout as well. But I wanted to ask you, out of all those other indicators, the key indicators that you just mentioned, what are the top two or three that you like to look at outside of population growth?
So of those five, the one that is most critical unquestionably is job growth. So what I tell people is, sometimes people ask me, so you have five indicators. What if you want to weigh them and not have everything have the same exact weightage? And I say, yeah, that's a more advanced strategy. But if you wanted to weigh them, I would say job growth would be 40% and the other four indicators would be 15% each. Right? So population growth being 15%, home price growth 15%, income growth 15%, crime reduction 15%, and job growth would be 40%. And, you know, I've been teaching this course for about 4 or 5 years, and at no point has that point been made better than in the last 30 days. So you're seeing other indicators of the economy doing really well. But as you can imagine, today is the most catastrophic job loss market in, you know, over 100 years. And so you can see the impact that it is having on real estate immediately. So, you know, in my mind, job growth is the Uber factor.
Sure.
Absolutely. We're actually going to get into a little bit of the COVID-19 and, and kind of how that's affecting your portfolio and what steps you're taking. But before we delve into that, I wanted to ask, so you've gone over some of the five key metrics you look for when before you invest in a city. Do you have any other sub-metrics that you look at for investing in a specific neighborhood? So like we've talked about Neighborhood Scout, do you pull up demographics and say, okay, here's an asset that was sent to me, and then look at, for example, median household income or crime, or do you have a top two or three statistics getting more specific for neighborhood?
Absolutely. So when we're looking at the neighborhood rules, also I start with income. So I like to invest in neighborhoods that are between 41 and 71,000 in income. And you might say, why not higher than 71? The answer is you're going to have trouble finding cash flowing properties if the neighborhood's income is higher than 71K. But if you're investing for yourself, you might want to go a little bit higher. If you're investing with investor money, they need cash flow. You'll have trouble finding properties that cash flow above that 70K level. So I think that 41 to 71K is kind of a sweet spot in terms of neighborhood income. You can find that information on Neighborhood Scout or on city-data.com for your neighborhood. And then the second one is median contract rent. Once again, there's a Goldilocks zone between 700 and 1,000. In, you know, really rich states like California, you obviously have to take that $1,000 number up. But most of the U.S. works really well between 700K and 1,000 in contract rent. Those are good areas to invest in. If the number's lower than 700, then you'll see high delinquency. You might see high occupancy, but you're going to have a lot of delinquency, a lot of people leaving, and a lot of, you know, legal costs due to eviction filing. So I strongly suggest that you don't go below 700.
Good point.
And then the other one is the unemployment rate. So you want, you know, the city's unemployment rate for any city in the U.S., you know, you can just type Buffalo, New York or New York City space, you know, unemployment rate, and Google will give it to you. You do not want that neighborhood's unemployment rate to be more than 2.5% higher than the city's. So if the city is New York and New York is at 4.1% jobless rate, then you want your neighborhood to not be higher than 6.6%. Because in recessions, just like the one that we have today, that 2.5% difference becomes magnified. It becomes three times larger. And it becomes a huge problem if you have 15 or 20% unemployment rate in the neighborhood that you're in during a recession. So keeping the gap between the cities and the neighborhoods unemployment rate to about to less than 2.5% is a best practice.
Good stuff. So this is kind of a good natural segue then into the current market conditions. There's shockwaves going through every facet of the economy due to COVID-19, the restrictions on the economy right now and what people can do, people unable to work, things like that. So just from a top-down view, what are you doing asset management-wise with your portfolio to take this punch that we're getting on the economy? And then maybe after that, we could talk a little bit about what you foresee happening over the next 6 months to a year. But first and foremost, what are you doing right now to manage all of this?
I think in that communication with tenants is really the key. And so we are doing a lot of offensive tactics and a lot of defensive tactics, right? So on the offensive side, we're assessing the health of our community. We're making sure that our community, you know, we're doing daily monitoring of COVID cases. We're not talking with our property managers once a week. We're talking to them once a day. And in case the tenants get COVID-19, which by the way, hasn't happened at our, you know, communities yet, but it's only a matter of time. We're then basically immediately trying to figure out what the CDC's requirements are in that area so that we don't end up in a situation where people are fleeing our property. Another defensive measure that we use, or I should say offensive measure, is we are giving them a very comprehensive list of services that may assist them during the pandemic at federal and county and state levels for individuals and small businesses. And that's worked really well for us because it's also started a two-way communication between us and tenants. And then every one of our properties, we're evaluating at-risk tenants. We have one property that's very close to Atlanta Airport. Obviously, those are people that are at risk because the airport is effectively shut down. We've got another property that has a lot of people that are working in retail. So we're evaluating each property to understand our risk level and our response is appropriate. So we have some properties where our response has simply been that if you give us rent by the first, we'll give you a $50 credit. And that's it. Because we think that that profile of tenants, they're not blue collar tenants, they're white collar tenants, and they're unlikely to be affected in the month of April. So we're doing very little there. Whereas with other properties, we're being much more aggressive and offering a lot of flexibility. We're being very focused on leasing right now. And we've actually had a surprising amount of luck in lease up using, you know, electronic methods. We're using a lot of video. We're using a lot of pictures to lease up our properties. And we've had a lot of luck. Our occupancy has actually increased by about 2% on average across our portfolio, or 1.5% in the last 2 weeks, which is great because you want to go into this crisis with the highest possible physical occupancy that you can imagine. Of course, people might tell me and say, no, Neil, those people just want to come in and pay you rent for a month and then not pay rent for a few months. And if that's the case, fine. But we made sure that we were taking quality tenants with quality backgrounds in. And so if it ends up being that they want to be squatters, then fine, so be it. So we're doing a lot of online leasing initiatives, which we don't see a lot of other companies doing that aggressively. And then we are talking with our lenders. We know exactly what's happening with the lenders. We know what all of our options are. We have three different options that we can go after. There's small business loans that we can trigger. There's this $10,000 grant that we can go after. There's the forbearance from our lenders, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And then there's another loan option that we have besides the $10,000 grant. So we're looking at every one of those options. Keep in mind also that if we can show that we've been hurt, our payroll can be paid by the government, right? So there's money for that. And so we're preparing to make sure that our staff at the various properties, we are able to bill their cost back to the government as part of the bailout bill.
Neil, that's great about your occupancy being pretty strong right now going into this, the midst of this possible recession that's looming. A lot of operators that we talk to are going flat to negative with lease renewals, and some are giving a lot of concessions away for a lot of their new lease ups. For the operators out there that maybe are in the middle of a lease up phase, or maybe they just recently renovated a bunch of units that they're trying to lease up, what kind of techniques or tips would you provide to those individuals?
Well, firstly, I would say it's a little bit too soon for you to be doing concessions. You're really hurting yourself because these tenants are all talking to each other. To do concessions when the industry hasn't been hurt yet, obviously today is the 31st of March, so we'll know more about this tomorrow. My feedback is one size doesn't fit all because every property, you're in a different situation. So what we've been doing is looking at our properties to see how much cash do we have at each property, right? Some of our properties can survive without any rents for a year. Some of the others can survive for less than 6 months without rent. So by looking at each property, we are determining an appropriate response. But the first thing that we're doing is not being overly aggressive with concessions because that spreads in a property very quickly. We're just telling our tenants, look, we're here to help you. If you need help, show us proof that you've been laid off and we'll find ways to help you, but we're not going to be offering concessions. You still need to pay rent. You still owe rent. And even though we've had one or two tenants come back to us and say, you can't evict us. And the answer is sure, but it's going to damage your credit. And we can still go through the entire eviction process. The sheriff won't come out in the month of April, but it's possible that they'll come out in May or June. Do you want to take that chance? And we've had people back off. So bottom line is, don't be overly aggressive yet. It's not clear how much the apartment industry gets hit. No one knows, but we're going to find out by the 15th.
So you mentioned the possibility of, or some of the options you've looked at, and some of these are new to me. I wasn't aware that some of these are available to operators. So you mentioned, for example, the small business loan. To your knowledge, is that available to syndicators out there holding this property under an LLC? I guess just kind of expound upon how you could qualify for that small business loan.
It's not a loan. It's a grant.
Oh,
it's money
okay.
You don't need to pay back. It's $10,000. It's got very few strings attached to it, and it's silly not to do it. So it's a terrific grant. And I think it's, you know, if you Google $10,000 grant, you'll see a lot of articles on how to go about it. So as far as I'm concerned, it's free money and we should take it. Keep in mind, we have to prove that we've been hurt. So you can't apply for that grant yet because I have no proof that any of my properties have been hurt yet. But by April 15th, if I pull my rent roll for March 15th and I look at how much money has been paid and then I pull it for April 15th, and if there's a difference, there's a gap, then I can prove that I've been hurt so I can qualify for that grant. So that's a grant. That's a big one. I mean, grant equals free money.
Sure. And curious, Neil, what are you seeing out there in the lending side? I know we've been encouraging a lot of individuals, whether it's residential or a commercial mortgage that they hold, to go out there and talk to their lenders early and often and take advantage of any of these mortgage deferral programs that are available. What are you seeing on your end in terms of the lenders that you're speaking to? And how in depth are they going in terms of asking you for proof of financials and that sort of thing?
So it depends on the type of lender. There's Fannie, there's Freddie, and then there's everybody else. So for the loans that we have, where we have individual banks that have loaned us money and they're not basically just brokering Fannie and Freddie loans, everybody's different, but those guys are pretty quick. I mean, they've just sent us, okay, here's our list of stuff. If you want to apply, go ahead. So, you know, when it's not a Fannie or Freddie loan, it's all over the place, but generally they seem to be more flexible and they can get you onto forbearance fairly quickly. So you stop paying your mortgage. with Fannie and Freddie, their guidelines are very close to each other. And what they're saying is, we'll give you 90 days of forbearance, but you have to first prove it. And I think nobody knows because nobody has yet received Fannie and Freddie forbearance yet. And most apartment loans tend to be, you know, bigger properties tend to be either Fannie or Freddie loans. So nobody loans yet because they haven't yet approved anybody. Because what they're saying is you have to first prove it to us, and no one can really prove it until April 1st.
Very true.
So what will happen is over the next week or two, we'll have a lot of information coming in anecdotally from our lenders and from our brokers on what that process is and whether they will allow us to do forbearance in April or whether they will force us to wait until May.
Very true.
You already talked about how, I mean, you've mentioned several times, I mean, we just simply don't know because we're waiting for April 1st to roll around and kind of see what the effect on the industry is going to be. But if you had a crystal ball just looking forward into the next 6 months to a year, what do you foresee happening in the industry or in the market in general? Is this ripple effect going to last for the next year plus? Are you seeing anticipating cap rates decompressing? What are your thoughts?
So I do see cap rates decompressing. I do not at this point, I believe that, and you know, I don't know if you guys have attended them, but I've been doing coronavirus webinars and I'm very confident that not just the United States, but pretty much all of the Western world is on the right path. You know, if we call this the hammer, it is working. We are hammering the virus down. I see the daily growth rates decline in the US and in all of the countries that I'm tracking, France, Germany, Italy, UK, all seeing daily growth rates decline every single day. So we're on a great path here with regards to the virus itself. I think by the end of April, you know, mid-May, we should be in a good place where we can, you know, consider opening up our economy from some restrictions so that we don't get too much of a spread once we reopen the economy. I think we're going to figure that out. I have a high level of confidence. What I feel, though, is that the damage that we've done to the economy worldwide, not just in the US, some of it is irreversible. I'm looking at oil markets and they're getting slaughtered, right? So they're talking about oil falling to $10 a barrel simply because every oil tanker in the world, people are paying two times, three times what they were before because they need someplace to store oil. So those markets, once they get hurt, it's very difficult for them to rebound in the short term. Same thing for restaurants. A lot of restaurants that closed will never reopen. So I think a lot of the damage is more extensive than people realize. So I'm very bullish that the virus's lockdown period will be shorter than most people believe. But I'm very bearish that the US and the world economy will bounce back in the next few weeks after that, simply because there's too much damage that is being done by this thing for it there to be an immediate bounce back, which is why I think that cap rates will decompress. Not in Q2, because how can cap rates decompress when there's no way to do transactions? Right now, you can't transact anything because you can't even do due diligence. Lenders are so slow. The credit markets are more or less frozen. So I really don't see cap rates decompressing in Q2, but I see them decompressing in Q3, possibly Q4, before they stabilize maybe at the end of the year. So there's going to be a lot of damage in Q3 and Q4. I think people are overly bullish that, you know, this is like of category 5 storm. Once the storm is gone, 5 days later, the business is, you know, back to usual. No, I see a massive amount of underlying damage to the world economy.
Neil, I want to talk about buying opportunities out there in the marketplace when we come out of this. Never before have the three immutable laws of real estate investing been more important than today. Buy for cash flow, secure long-term debt, and have plenty of cash reserves. We know there's been a lot of operators out there in the last couple of years that have been getting into skinny deals, deals that barely penciled out on paper. And we believe that as an outcome of this recession or this environment that we're in today, a lot of those operators are going to have a challenging time hitting pro forma. Do you believe that ultimately this is going to lead to some of these deals going back to the bank and many deals to be had in the marketplace come, you know, Q3 or 4 of this year?
Yes, but not as many as you think. A lot of these operators, yes, the deals were very skinny. They paid up a lot. We paid up a lot. So, you know, it's everybody that was in that marketplace that did. I think that some of them are well capitalized. I don't think that they're going to give up and let the deals go back to the bank just because of a short-term blip. I do very strongly feel that we're going to get rents back in line by July. So I don't see a lot of properties going under just because of rent. I think that the properties that will go under are the ones that were mismanaged before March. So in Jan and Feb, they're already mismanaged. They're already in trouble. And then coronavirus makes everything worse. And then by the time rents come back in June or July, July most likely, they've lost so much money that they're close to defaulting. And those are the properties that slide into default. But don't expect to see large-scale defaults unless the credit markets freeze up. They are frozen for the moment, but I do expect them to unfreeze over the next month or two. I mean, right now, just everything's just frozen. You really can't get a substantial-sized loan today if you wanted to.
Sure, that's interesting. And I'm curious, in terms of today is March 31 and tomorrow is April 1, so that tomorrow will be the start of the first full month where we're going to start to kind of see delinquencies and how big that spike is. So a couple of weeks from now, you'll be able to tell. I'm curious, in terms of what you're projecting, how large of a spike in delinquencies are you expecting for April across your portfolio and then also in May?
So April, we're projecting 20 to 30%. In May, we're projecting 30 to 50%.
Ooh, that's high, 30 to 50, huh?
It depends on where the virus is on May 1st. I am personally a bit more bullish. My staff is a little more bearish. I'm more bullish because I'm looking at the virus's daily growth rate and it's dropping very quickly. Mm-hmm. Now it is. I mean, in the early states, so Washington, California, New York, it's dropping very quickly. Obviously, some of the other states are not even in full shelter in place yet, so it's not dropping. But in my mind, once they realize that they have no other options and the only way to beat this thing is to use shelter in place, they will go there. I think at this point, 28 or 29 U.S. states, which is 75% of our population, is already in shelter in place. So that's a big ding, right? Mm-hmm. You know, airports are more or less closed down. International travel is closed down. So it's not like only 75% of the population is exercising social distancing. I think the number is well over 90%. And we're seeing very positive trends from that. The public is not going to see those trends. I mean, if you go to CNN's homepage, they're screaming about massive numbers of deaths that are rising and each day is setting a new record and Trump is warning of painful 2 weeks ahead. I get all of that. That's all true. And it's human life, so you can't trivialize it. But the point is, the math shows that the virus is slowing. The impact of that slowdown, you cannot feel today. You have to feel 15 days from now. Because the cases that you're going to see in the next 15 days that will result in deaths were all cases from the previous 15 days. So there's a 15-day lag.
Sure.
So in my mind, I think that we could have a better May than we think. But if we are still in nationwide lockdown in May, yes, 30 to 50%, it's something that you should expect.
I'm curious, and you don't need to answer this question if you don't feel comfortable, but I'm curious, have you gone to all your investors and stopped distributions for the next quarter or two? And do you foresee a lot of operators out there having to do capital calls?
Yes. So we immediately stopped distributions. That was one of the first things that we did. We absolutely anticipate capital calls. Yes, there's going to be quite a few capital calls in the next 60 to 90 days. And those capital calls could begin as soon as May.
Wow. Neil, I'd like to move on to and pivot away from the COVID stuff just a little bit and kind of just talk also about sort of what you're known for with your extreme take on your analytics. You're amazing and a master at it. And you also have some, I would consider them a little bit unconventional methods for how you approach asset management that I really think are pretty amazing. I'd like you to share with our audience. So first and foremost, you've spoken on numerous other podcasts about a team that you have in the Philippines that you dedicate to helping you improve your asset management. Can you get into that a little bit? Give us an overview of what this team does, what that even means, and how you've used it to improve your operations today and before today.
Sure. So I've always believed that the way that we do asset management and the way that we do property management in the US is not cutting edge. It's very old style. We don't use any kind of offshore labor, which makes no sense. A huge amount of the work that is being done can be done offshore. So for my properties, I hire a regular property manager. And then on top of that, I bolt a team called the Efficiency Center. And so I have 19 full-time employees in the Philippines. They all work 8 to 5 Pacific, and some of them work property time. So, you know, Atlanta properties will have people working Atlanta hours and so on and so forth. And so what these people do is that they optimize my properties in a number of different ways. The two biggest ones that appear to be a universal to all of my properties are they generate a massive number of tenant leads. And remember, I'm bolting them on top of an existing property manager. So I'm not replacing a PM and I have no intentions of ever being a property manager. So what this team is doing is they're going out and promoting the property at 40 or 50 different websites. We've got a number of very unique techniques to increase the lead flow vastly beyond what any other property in the US gets. So they generate about 20,000 tenant leads a year. And then the second component is a call center, and it's open 13 hours a day from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern. And that call center then processes those 20,000 leads in real time, within 5 minutes or less of those leads coming in. Internet leads are crap if you don't process them immediately, because people are filling out forms at, you know, like for 10 different companies. And so the first one to reach the person always gets the appointment. So we have a 5 minute rule during a workday where lead comes in, we process it immediately, and we schedule the appointment into the property management software, which is usually AppFolio or Yardi. And then 1 day before the appointment, we remind them. 1 hour before the appointment, we send them a text message. And if they don't show up, then we take that lead back and reschedule it. If they do show up, then the property management takes it from there. So that is, we call it mega leasing and mega marketing. So full-time employees, a call center that we own ourselves. So it's not a third-party call center. All of them are our own employees. We know that it works. I mean, our properties have very high occupancy rates, both physical and economic, compared to our competitors. It's a unique service. I know a lot of people think it's too much. It's not true asset management. As far as I'm concerned, maybe they haven't seen my profit checks.
What you're saying is really resonating with me right now, Neil, because all of the points you were making as you went across all of these, it just made me think of us and our own property. Because, I mean, when it comes to property management, you're paying them that fee. When it comes to the marketing and the generation of leads, I mean, I don't want to say they're necessarily doing the bare minimum, but they're going to, you know, input the property's information on some software that's then going to push it out to Zillow, apartments.com, all that kind of stuff. And that's usually, you know, the extent of their online marketing. And when it comes to some of the other more powerful ways of marketing that we've realized, for example, Facebook Marketplace and Facebook ads, we've realized an enormous amount of attention. A lot of people are spending a lot of time on Facebook. But if our property manager makes the Facebook Marketplace ad for us, they're also not going to sit there on Facebook Messenger all day and respond to dozens of leads, then messaging them like, hey, is this still available? Can I schedule a viewing?
Yeah, and it's a very powerful mechanism, right? So Facebook Marketplace gives us a huge amount of leads, but Facebook Marketplace is a conversational methodology. You cannot simply put out your property there, because 99% of the people say the same thing. Hey, is this still available? I don't know why people say that, but that's what they do. And then you have to have a conversation with them. And the ones that we turn into leads are the ones that you, a human being is actually going back and answering their questions and then scheduling an appointment. You can't just say, well, we'll answer your questions, you know, please schedule an appointment. That never works on Facebook. So having a person whose job it is to chat with people all day for 10 different properties is very powerful. So the reason why we find that it's very powerful is because we are able to have the same person do it across properties. I'm not sure if it would be cost effective to do it for one property or two.
Yeah, exactly. I think that that human interaction and that level of attention that's needed is just something that you're not usually going to get out of property managers. So we've kind of taken this on ourselves, just because, you know, we haven't yet done, you know, reached out to get like a virtual assistant to take over this for us. But we've noticed a doubling in our leads in just a matter of 1 week. And in addition to that, we've implemented some other tactics of, you know, putting a new ad on Craigslist every hour or 2 hours and just keeping that fresh on the front page. But a lot of these things you're just not going to get out of a property manager. So I could see how when you've got your army working for you, they're just providing that extra level of work that you're not going to find elsewhere. And I can imagine, I can totally see how you're just going to be generating an insane amount of leads based off of that.
In the end, it comes down to leases. So we do a monthly meeting. It was right before this podcast. So the hour before this podcast was me sitting down property by property, going through the Efficiency Center tracker and getting confirmations by looking at the rent roll of the property and matching that up with the incoming lead. So we can say this many leases were signed because of the Efficiency Center. This many leases were signed because of the property manager. And many of the properties, we're at 50% of that number. I mean, 50% is such a colossal number. well, you know, you truly understand it, it's the difference between being at 92% occupied and being at 97 or 98.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Neil, what are some other ways that you improve efficiency with this team? I've heard you mention before things like improving the efficiency of signing people for covered parking. I've heard of improving the efficiency of finding tenants that have pets that aren't necessarily paying for them. Can you get into some of those or any other ways that you have them working for you?
Sure. Well, one of the patented methods that I invented that's very powerful is that we will install cameras, 4K if possible, if not possible, 1080p cameras. And the cameras are not pointing to the parking lots. They're pointing to the staircase. And so what happens is that these are motion capture cameras, and we give the login to a person in the Philippines, and we basically tell them, keep looking at the picture for days on end until you see a person with a pet. And if you see a person with a pet, let's say they've got a cat or a dog, watch them go up the staircase, watch them walk the hallway until they reach a unit. And then here's a 2D floor plan. Try and figure out which unit number it is. And once you figure out the unit number, take a blurry cam picture on the screen of that person with their dog, and you know the best lit picture you can find, and send it with the unit number to the property manager. The property manager, of course, will immediately email it to the tenant and say, hey, clearly you have this beautiful fluffy cat, and you know, but you're not paying pet rent. And my team only sends it to the property manager if and only if they go into AppFolio and they don't find a pet rent line. If they find a pet rent line, they ignore it. If they don't find it, they send it. And then the property manager basically talks to the tenant and says, hey, clearly you haven't been paying. You know, according to my lease, I could charge you pet rent for every single month of your lease, but I'm going to be nice to you if you come into the property today, come into the leasing office today, pay the one-time fee, and I'll add the monthly fee from this month onwards. And everybody does it because they're caught on camera. So, I mean, it's a very inexpensive process. It costs about 10 hours, you know, at $5 an hour on a monthly basis, but you catch tons and tons of people with pets. So it's a very extraordinarily profitable.
How many people have you caught, like just as like a case study? I mean, have you caught a significant amount of people that were not telling you that they had pets, but you were able to get them on the pet rent?
I'm going to get in trouble if I say that. So I'm just going to say it's more substantial than you might think. So there are states in the U.S. where 50% of the tenants have pets, but I've never had a property that I've bought where pet rent was coming in from more than 20% of the units at the time of purchase.
Yeah, it's a pretty easy thing for most people to try to get away with. So I can see how they're going to try their luck and try to get away with it. But yeah, exactly.
But then, you know, there's other services that we do, you know, 90-day renewal calls. We get reviews. So, you know, we getting Google reviews, getting Yelp reviews, apartments.com reviews is key. And what we do is we wait until a maintenance call is done. And then we call in, we check on the maintenance call. We say, you know, would you give that maintenance call? What would be your rating from 1 to 10? If they say 9 or 10, we'd go to the next step. If they say 8 or less, then, you know, if they say 8, we don't do anything. If they say 7 or less, we send the maintenance person back because clearly he did an awful job. And if they say 9 or 10, then we say, hey, in a minute, you'll see a text message on your phone with a link. If you have a few minutes, could you please write us a review? So in one part of the year, that goes to Google. Another part of the year, it goes to Yelp. Another part of the year, it goes to apartments.com. Mm-hmm. So that way, we try and get reviews on all of these key sites. And it's very hard work because you have to, you know, send 20 or 30 of those links to get one review.
For sure. Another one of your patented methods that I've heard you talk about before that I thought was amazing was how you employ your army to improve your efficiency of getting people to sign up for those parking spaces that are covered. Can you tell our listeners about how you do that? It's pretty cool.
Sure. So the parking spaces, you shouldn't waste your time calling people every day of the year. So bottom line is, have a person that is looking at the temperature at the property. Only call on days that are very hot or days that are extremely cold and have snow, because you're much more likely to sell your parking product on extremely hot days or on extremely cold and snowy days. Those are the days that everyone wishes they had a covered parking spot. So those are the days that we call, and we get a significant conversion on those days. So every day in the morning, they just spend a minute checking the temperature and deciding which property they're going to call on that particular day. People forget this. They forget that no one's, if you just call them, and it's not super hot that day, they're not going to buy a covered parking spot because their car isn't baking at 100 degrees. So a lot of it is about systems and processes, not people in the Philippines. You just have to do things when they have the greatest return. And what we found is nothing sells covered parking like a 110-degree day.
Yeah, that is really, really good advice right there, Neil. I wanted to ask you, out of all the platforms that are out there in terms of marketing, you know, renovated units or any vacant units, you have Zillow, Hotpads, Trulia, you got your apartments.com, you got Facebook Marketplace. Which one is your go-to and why?
I'd say Facebook Marketplace and RentLinks are kind of my two go-tos simply because they give us unique leads that we can't get easily on the others. Zillow and apartments.com are beginning to become more and more expensive over time. And so it's a challenge. I mean, 5 years ago when I started doing all this stuff, every platform was free, even RentLinks was free. I wouldn't be surprised that we end up paying something for Facebook Marketplace in the future. So, you know, RentLinks and Facebook Marketplace are pretty awesome.
Are there any other methods that we haven't talked about that you like to use your army to improve efficiency? Because I just think that most of the stuff that they're doing is amazing. Or is there anything else that's kind of unique that you have them do?
Delinquency management, making phone calls on the 6th, 7th, and then 12th and 13th. Actual physical calls where a person is calling is a huge amount of pressure. We've had properties where the tenants come in into the clubhouse and say, here's my money. Please don't have that Filipino lady, the nice lady, call me again.
I like that.
So it works, right? I mean, delinquency management is really key.
Yeah, absolutely. So as far as like how you developed this army, I mean, for those out there that aren't using any virtual assistants at all, or they're hearing you say this right now, and they're like, oh my God, I got to build an army right now, like Neil. How do they go about doing that? I mean, what services do you use? I mean, how do you get this many people in the Philippines to work for you?
That is a very long answer. So the short version of that answer is Google Neil Bawa Virtual Assistant Podcast. And I've done podcasts where I've spent an hour explaining where to hire them, how to hire them, how much to pay them, how to train them, how to create accountability. So I've done long, hour-long podcasts on that topic because it's really not something that's trivial. If you just go run off to Upwork.com and hire somebody, you're going to fall flat on your face, I guarantee it. Because I felt flat on my face the first three or four attempts. I had to build a lot of efficiencies into the system to make it work.
Okay, very interesting.
Neil, I wanted to pivot a little bit now and just kind of jump into some demographic trends and how it pertains to supply-demand factors moving forward. Do you, first of all, feel like this environment that we're in today, regardless if it lasts another month and we come back and pop back really quickly, or if it lasts and drags on a little bit further and does more damage than a lot of people are anticipating, do you feel like it's going to cause a pullback in new supply in the coming years? And then number two, where do you see multifamily demand in general going over the next 10 to 15 years?
I think that there is no doubt in my mind that multifamily is a privileged asset class. And the best way that I can prove that is this. It's been proven that after food, shelter is the second thing that people will put money in their pocket for. Of course, these days it's more food than Netflix than shelter. So I'm glad Netflix is only 10 bucks a month. But what is happening is that today, the cash money that the government is providing from the coronavirus fund is actually going into our pockets. And, you know, that's not happening for hotels. That's not happening for retail. The money that is coming to those tenants is not going to their local restaurant. It is going to pay rent. Nothing proves that multifamily is a privileged asset class than the whole coronavirus debacle. So I'm very bullish on it. And I think that the market is beginning to realize that want-based areas such as retail, such as hotels, don't deserve to be anywhere near the cap rate of need-based assets such as multifamily.
Sure.
So my belief is one of the key benefits, long-term benefits that we get from this debacle is that we get to see lower cap rates on multifamily. Do we get to see them this year? No. Do we get to see them next year? No. But I think over time, once the market heals, you can expect to see even lower cap rates on the multifamily asset class. And it deserves it because it's a need-based asset. I do believe that because of what happened with coronavirus, you're going to see a lot less new construction. New construction projects will slow over the next year. And that is going to make the supply-demand equation worse and drive up rents, not in the short term. Once again, I want to keep warning people that a lot of revenue that's lost is going to be lost. You cannot bring it back. So in the short term, everything is going to be cheaper. I expect that even multifamily is going to have some cap rate decompression happen, which means, you know, cap rates will go up a little bit, which means prices will go down. We're not going to be doing a lot of transactions in the second half of the year for multifamily, but there's going to be some where there will be discounts. I'm pretty sure of that. But in the long run, once the market is healthy again, I believe that multifamily is going to do really, really well.
So that's really good. Now, what are your thoughts in terms of capital and access to capital, whether it's on the lending side or securing private capital, such as investors? Do you feel like that's going to be a little bit more challenging to come by because of what we're in today?
Investor capital is definitely far more challenging to come by. But I think that if the stock market went back up, let's say 3 months, 4 months from now, I think that the investor money will become available again. Lending capital will take a lot more time to come back. There's a lot of overly bullish people saying, oh yeah, the moment the country reopens, the lending capital will come back. And the answer is no, because everyone's rent rolls will have been damaged. There will have been more debt added in. I don't think the lenders are going to, you know, loosen things up very quickly. I mean, Fannie Mae is now requiring 12 months worth of mortgage payments and taxes as impounds.
Oh, wow.
And that's going to have a very strong impact on cap rates. Cap rates will go up because of that, because now on a $20 million project, you need to raise $1.2 million more from your equity, and equity is a little spooked right now. So it's going to be really difficult to do a lot of transactions in Q2 and Q3. So I don't expect the price to go down a lot, but I expect the transaction volume to decline a great deal because of what the lenders are doing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, got it. So your terms that the lender provides you might be a little bit less of an LTV, a little bit less leverage. You're going to have to come in with more money down possibly and more in reserves. So it sounds like there might be a trickle-down effect, and eventually that's going to bring some sale prices down as well. Do you agree?
That's my belief, that there's a strong trickle-down effect. Yes, lenders are spooked. And again, if you have to give them $1.2 million more for a $20 million property, that's going to significantly affect your IRRs. And when it starts affecting IRRs, investors are going to stay away, which means that prices will come down because a lot of deals will not go through.
Mm-hmm. Neil, as we get towards the tail end of the show here, one of the sections that we like to do with every show is talk about our guest's first-class deal, which is just our way of calling your favorite deal. Would you like to talk about your favorite deal that you've ever done in your career as a multifamily investor? If so, what is this deal? How many units? And can you just give us some general information about it?
Sure. It's a Class B property called Park Canyon. It is in Dalton, Georgia. Dalton does really well on our numbers, and nobody knows where the heck Dalton, Georgia is. It's actually, it serves the Chattanooga, Tennessee market, even though it's in Georgia. So this is a Class B property. We loved it. We bought it from the Coca-Cola family, who had held it for 30 straight years. So it was built in 1989.
Wow.
Our property was in phenomenal shape. Most of the staff had worked there for more than 20 years. So we've had no maintenance issues with this particular property, and we've had no delinquency. So this month is our 15th month of ownership, and we finally had $750 worth of delinquency. The previous 14 months, the delinquency of this property was zero, not zero on a monthly basis, zero over 14 straight months. So who doesn't like a property like that? So we're very significantly ahead on our distribution schedule. The biggest advantage of this property was, because it did so well, I was able to do something that is extraordinarily rare. So there were 20 units that were burned down at this property in a corner somewhere. And the Coca-Cola people knew about it, but they didn't really charge us for it. So we ended up getting basically those 20 burned units for free. And the reason they didn't charge us is because the bank that we took the loan over from them, that bank was opposed to doing a supplemental loan until the construction was done. So the bank didn't want to add a supplemental until after we built them for free. Mm-hmm. We built them. And so building 20 units, you know, if you're doing it without any kind of lending, you know, you need $2 million in cash. But because the property was doing so well, I was able to convince my investors, who had already invested in the property, to give me $2 million, but not give it to me as equity, because if they gave it to me as equity, that would dilute the whole project. Mm-hmm. They gave it to me as short-term equity, which is like a loan. So I'm paying them 1% interest on it per month, so 12% a year. And when the property is built and I refinance, I just pay that money back to them. So they end up making 1% a month, but they also end up getting those 20 units. I was able to convince the city to build 29 very large units instead of 20 and reuse the foundation that was already there. And so the property's value is going to go up by about $4 million. So when I refinance that particular property, because I've already built so much equity in the last year and a half, I'm going to be able to get a supplemental loan that's over $6 million.
Wow.
Return the $2 million that the investors have given me, return 100% of their capital, pay myself, and then keep the property for the next 10 years.
Wow.
That's incredible. You just blew my mind. Were there other value add components as well with this deal? I mean, was that whole 20 unit burn down the main thing that attracted you to this deal? Or are you also renovating the rest of the units and doing things like that to raise rents or whatever?
Renovating all the units. So it's a standard value add property. Because it's a B, not a C, I'm going granite countertop. So I'm spending $8,500 a unit and I'm getting about $195 in my rent pops. So yeah, it was a standard value add property. But what made it a superstar property was the 20 units that I was able to convert. I built 29 units. They're almost built. They're in construction. I built 29 units plus 20 storage units. So 20 storage units and 29 full-size units. And I've also had a little bit of luck. The state of Georgia considers construction to be essential. So my construction has not been affected at all by the coronavirus. So the foundation is already poured and the superstructure is now coming up. The weather has been kind to us as well.
Curious, Neil, how did you source this deal? And then also, were you already in this market prior to this?
No, it came through me through a partner of mine. So bottom line is I travel the U.S. and the biggest reason I travel, you know this, I mean, I'm teaching at a conference every other week. Mm-hmm. And the biggest reason I do that is deals come to me. So if you want a huge amount of deal flow, you've really got to go out there and shake a lot of hands. These days, of course, elbow bump. But shake a lot of hands.
Sure. And so I'm curious, getting into a newer market that's a little bit off the beaten path, but still has good population growth, good employment growth, and just good overall dynamics. You find a good deal like this, but you're not already in it. What's that process like in terms of finding a good third-party property manager? And any pointers or tips that you could give to another investor that's maybe getting into a newer market like that in terms of finding a really good PM?
I think finding a really good PM is a art and a science, and a lot of it is just you calling and talking with property managers. Somewhere, I don't know exactly how to give it to you, but I have a list of 60 questions that I ask a property manager. It takes 75 minutes. I rarely get all the way to the end because these questions tell me if I've got the right property manager on the line. And even then, we tend to change our property managers out at least once during a five-year hold. So there's a lot to it that you can't know in advance. I'm not going to go to a particular market just because I have a good property manager there. But if it's a small market, I make sure that the property manager is a really good one. As it happens, my best property manager is at this property. It's SMP. And they came with the property. I didn't change them out. So in this instance, one of the reasons I liked the property the most was there really wasn't anything wrong with it. They'd held it for 30 years. The reason they were selling it is because they were done with the depreciation. It didn't make sense for them to keep holding.
Neil, do you have many other properties that are in like these secondary or tertiary markets, smaller markets throughout the United States? Because, I mean, like even for our property, we avoided some of the major markets just because they were so competitive at the peak of the market just to over throughout 2019. Do many of your properties kind of follow a similar model like that?
They do. Tucson, St. George. I mean, I don't have properties in Phoenix, but I have one in Mesa, Arizona. I don't have properties in Orlando, but I have one in Jacksonville. Mm-hmm. I like the secondary markets and I don't like primaries. I think that they're ridiculously expensive.
Yeah, agreed. Neil, we'll go ahead and transition towards the end of our show right now, which is called the takeoff round. We're just going to ask you four questions that we ask all our guests that just require very quick answers. So we'll just go ahead and head on into it. The first one is, what is the biggest mistake you've made in real estate investing?
Buying in Chicago. I bought a 237 unit that I'm still dealing with. And the big mistake wasn't necessarily buying in Chicago. It was buying based on future events. It was next to where the Obama Presidential Library is being built. The library got delayed by 3 years because of some frivolous lawsuit by the Friends of Jackson Park. And that really screwed up my business plan. So I know better than to buy based on upcoming events, regardless of how important they are and regardless of how likely they are. So buy based on existing, you know, events, not based on future events. That's what I learned.
Good point. Second question, how do you recommend others obtain the knowledge needed to get started and take off in real estate investing and get to your level eventually?
Well, there I can help you. Number one, I offer over 100 hours of free education every year through multifamilyu.com. That's multifamily followed by the letter u.com, including my location magic course, the three-year course that tells you how to use my metrics to find the best cities and neighborhoods in the U.S. for real estate investing. That's on the website. So are over 100 other webinars, including my coronavirus webinar, which is pretty popular. We've had over 2,000 people attend that in the last 10 days. And also, I teach a multifamily boot camp. And in the boot camp, which is three straight days, 10 hours a day, no pitch, no sales pitch, no upgrade, nobody selling anything, you get to see my business in real time. So there's about 60 demos that last over 10 hours of how I run my business. And it's up on the screen in front of you with us having a discussion about everything that we're doing. So like there's a 1.5 hour module on how we use virtual assistants, what systems we use, what methodologies we use, what do our dashboards look like? All of that stuff is in the bootcamp. So and it's a tenth of the cost of a typical multifamily education package. So it's about $3,000. Right now we're teaching it as an e-bootcamp, but it's usually held in a major city in the US.
If you could go back and tell your 25-year-old self one piece of advice, what would that be?
Be more candid with investors. Don't sugarcoat things. I've done it. I've suffered.
Final question. How can Multifamily Takeoff listeners get in touch with you?
The best way is multifamilyu.com. If you want to send me an email, it's N-E-A-L, and not N-E-I-L, but N-E-A-L at multifamilyu.com. Or contact me through my Facebook group. It's a phenomenal group with about 7,000 people. It's called Magic of Multifamily.
Thank you so much, Neil. This was an absolutely phenomenal podcast. You provided an incredible amount of good content for our listeners. We really appreciate it. And once we go offline here, hang tight for just a minute. But thanks again for coming.
Yeah, thanks again, Neil. This has been amazing.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you for listening to the Multifamily Takeoff Podcast. For more information regarding anything multifamily real estate investing related, or if you are interested in passively investing with us, visit themultifamilytakeoff.com and follow the show on Instagram at @themultifamilytakeoff. See you next week.